Whole Foods Market celebrates Earth Month with the Do Something Real Film Festival, a collection of six provocative, character-driven films focused on food, environmental issues, and everyday people with a greater vision. Come see one of the six features at City Cinemas Village East from Saturday, April 16th through Thursday, April 21st, every night at 6 p.m. Learn more about the films and special events at www.dosomethingreal.com. That's www.dosomethingreal.com. Sponsored by Whole Foods Market.
You're listening to Why We Cook on the Heritage Radio Network. Welcome to Why We Cook, the Chef Smarty Pants radio show. I'm Erica Wides, your host, Chef Smarty Pants. And lately, the past 4 days, I started watching Weeds. You know, the show that is, I guess, still on Showtime. I think it's Showtime. About a pot-dealing mom in the California suburbs. Now, I know I'm a few years behind schedule on this one, but I basically don't have cable, so it's taken me a few years to catch on. This is what happens with me. And now, through the magic of things like Netflix and Apple TV, I'm able to catch up on all those great series that have been made by all these cable channels in the last decade or so. Things that I've missed out on, although I still have yet to see a single episode of The Sopranos. I'm sort of proud to say one of these days I'll catch up on that. But the reason that I don't have cable, other than the free super basic stuff that comes into my apartment because there was a wire coming in the wall and I screwed it into my TV and I got basic reception and a few channels. But the reason I don't have anything else is that I don't think we should have to pay for commercial TV. If I have to sit through all those ads, why should I have to pay you to show them to me, right? When cable kind of first came on the scene in the 70s in my world, I thought that that was the point. Like, I thought that was why we had it, because you would pay for it, and because you were paying for it, there wouldn't be any ads. That was the deal I was told in the beginning, and, you know, I'm a little stubborn, so I'm kind of stuck on that still. You know, like public radio or PBS, you know, no ads, you pay. Ads, you don't pay. You know, and of course, in our little wacky world, our, you know, pickle-making, coal-heated little whacked house on the prairie in the suburbs, not only did we not have cable TV, we didn't even have a color TV. We had a black and white TV until I was in high school, and that was in the mid-80s. So that's, you know, that's where this all comes from. But the whole idea of paying so that you wouldn't have ads, I guess, went by the wayside early on. You know, like other 70s things, like, you know, smoking in your office or riding in the back of the station wagon, untethered. Seems to have fallen by the wayside. And now you pay and you get to watch a lot of ads. And that's happened in the movies too. Like in the past 10 years or so, you go to the movies and you pay and you watch ads also. And that makes me want to kill somebody. But anyway, back to Weeds. So I've been watching it and it's really good, which you're probably saying, yeah, we know that. We've been watching it now for 6 seasons. Where have you been? But it's Mary Louise Parker was really, she's really good as the widowed mom in the affluent suburb who starts dealing weed to support her kids. It's really good. I'm only 4 episodes into it and, you know, don't tell me anything else. Jack told me something from a future episode, but I already forgot what he said.
Sorry.
It's okay. I forgot already because I'm old and I forget things. But so I've always been kind of a slow adapter. That's the point I'm getting to here, is I'm a little bit of a slow adapter when it comes to a lot of things, to certain TV shows, new technology, new restaurants. I'm not the kind of person to rush out and try that stuff when it first comes out, or, you know, I don't want to be the first one to buy the latest, because I wait. I like to wait. And I'm a little skeptical about trendy things and the lasting power that they may have. And, you know, I want to make sure that my investment of my time or my money or my brain is going to pay off. You know, I'm thrifty. We've talked about that. Prudent, cheap, whatever you want to call it. I take my time and I wait it out. And if it's going to last, then I join in. There are a few exceptions, a few things that I tend to jump right in ahead of the curve. Like Mad Men, which I was the first one of everybody I know to watch, which I'm proud to say. I had read about it before it was even on. But a lot of other things, I let everybody else kind of try it out first, and then if it seems okay, then I'll join in also. So I'm that way with technology too. Like, we always have a little laugh here in the studio because my phone, my three-year-old BlackBerry, was dying, and I finally got a new one. And that's ridiculous. 3 years old should not be like an antique phone, but it basically was. But I got a new one. So anyway, a couple weeks ago at ICE, where I teach, there was this big event, this big special event, and the event was to celebrate the publication of a book called Modernist Cuisine. Now, by now, you've probably heard of it, if you're at all aware of what's going on in the food world. If you're not a super late adapter like me, it's a 5-volume, $600 book, although it's only $465 on Amazon. It's a book on food and science, and it's by Nathan Myhrvold, who was the CTO of Microsoft and retired very young and very rich, made millions, and decided to do like the definitive book on food and food science and on a modernist cuisine, formerly known as molecular gastronomy. He spent millions of his own money doing all the research, built this massive lab test kitchen facility, self-published it, etc., etc. It's been all over the media lately, the mainstream media, the food media. He was on the Today Show. It's a very big deal because it's the most expensive cookbook ever published and the heaviest. But it's also, it was quite an undertaking. It's a huge, huge, massive amount of information. So anyway, they threw this big party at ICE with, you know, all the kitchens having like a little tasting thing. You could walk around. There were like 5 things you could taste and, you know, a big multimedia presentation and a bar and celebrities and journalists and the whole thing, you know, it was a big deal. And I went because the faculty were invited to go, which was great. We were invited to go for free, which was even better. And it was really, it was fun. It was a great night. The presentation was fascinating. I had, you know, heard him on NPR and seen a bunch of stuff about the technology that they explored to create the book and the things they had developed and how they, you know, do these like cross sections of things actually cooking, you know, like a Weber grill cut in half while I was cooking, stuff like that. Great photography. And the food was really delicious and really interesting and amazing. And I got a chance to look at the book because the first print run of 5,000 of the book sold out, you know, like in 2 seconds or was pre-ordered, whatever. But my boss at school has a copy. He got a copy. So I got to take a look at it in his office. And so the event was really fun and really cool and, you know, I had a great time. But when I first heard about, you know, this idea, molecular cuisine or gastronomy, probably about 10 years ago, probably. And, you know, I had my doubts. I must say I had my doubts. It seemed like a silly trend, a way for, you know, nerdy boys in the kitchen who like to play with chemicals, make food less accessible and less real in a kind of elitist way. And in some cases, that's still exactly what it is. I never really embraced it because I never learned any of the technology, mostly because it all really came along after I had left restaurant kitchens and started teaching. So I never really got a chance to do any of it hands-on. And I kind of, you know, pishawed its value. And I've also eaten at some of the places where they embrace this sort of technology. And I have to say, like, some of it's really interesting and fun and delicious, and some of it's just not. And if it's not delicious fundamentally, I don't want to eat it. I don't care how interesting or scientific it is. you know, I ate pizza pebbles at WD-50 that were like something you should put in your laundry, you know, that should dissolve, but happen to taste like cheese. But then I also ate his you know, gelled hollandaise, which was a really amazing kind of cool way to reinterpret hollandaise. So it's kind of hit or miss. And, you know, I'm still not a huge fan of that kind of stuff because a lot of it incorporates chemicals. And a lot of them are corn-based chemicals. And a lot of them are chemicals that I wouldn't want to eat. And I wouldn't buy processed food that contains them. So why would I eat high-end food that contains them? So in my skeptical way, I'm still kind of waiting to see what'll shake out from this and what'll last. And, you know, what of this will go the way of, like, the blackened catfish of the 80s. You know, thank God that died a slow, smoldering death. But anyway, back to the book. The book isn't all about totally about all of that stuff. There's a lot of that stuff. It's in five volumes. But there's also a lot of science and a lot of really good in-depth science that takes everything we think of as gospel about how things are cooked and how to cook them and kind of turns it all on its head. So that's what got me excited about this book is that, you know, when I teach how to grill a steak, I say put the steak on the grill, leave it alone, turn it once. He says turn it every 15 seconds. You'll get a much more evenly cooked steak. You don't have to let it rest. I mean, like everything I've ever known and everything I've taught, I feel like I potentially have been wrong because somebody actually finally took the time to go into a lab and do this stuff and document it and test it out and find out what's really behind all these cooking rules that we've always just taken as, you know, as Talmudic, so to speak. So that's what kind of got me excited about this book. And believe it or not, I ordered one. Yes, me, Miss Thrifty. I ordered the $465 discount price, regularly $600 book or books from Barnes & Noble. No, from Amazon, because actually I have points that I can use. So it's not going to cost me that much. So yeah, me, the slow adapter, the cook who has never used an alginate or a foam siphon or gel and gum or even sous vide anything ever in the kitchen. You know, the TV watcher who's never seen Lost. The Mac user who still uses a BlackBerry. I ordered the book. I want it. It's like the Bible. It holds the key to the questions. It's the Torah, I think. I mean, at least the questions that people like Harold McGee haven't answered in other books. And I have all those other books. I have McGee and I have Shirley Courier's books and I have the What Einstein Taught His Cook. And all of those are great books, but I think that this may actually turn some of that stuff on its head, too. I mean, if Harold McGee had had millions of dollars to spend on his research, he probably would have done this same thing. So I guess I'm officially not a late adapter anymore. It's a new day for me. I'm not a late adapter. I'm only going to have to get the second printing, though, because I missed out on the first one. And, you know, even though the book won't be shipped until July, I still feel kind of cool. Like, I feel like those girls who, you know, back when I was in sixth grade had Jordache jeans. When I was still sporting my Sears Tough Skins in the Husky Girl size, you know, like that. Like I finally got on the train as it was waiting in the station, or maybe even caught the earlier one because I knew there was an earlier one coming. So now I just have to wait and wait for it to show up. And, you know, waiting isn't my best talent. I'm a little impatient, but I'll wait. And hopefully it'll be worth it when it comes in July. And until then, I have about six seasons of Weeds that I can watch in my spare time while I'm waiting. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk some more about slow adapting.
following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to Hot Grease every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Hot Grease strives to bring sustainability, localized sourcing, and other forward-thinking schools of culinary thought to the minds and kitchens of everyday folk. Each week, Nicole Taylor's conversations cover the entire spectrum of food enthusiasts, from internationally renowned culinary masters to moms on a budget looking to impress their tiniest critics. Again, that's every Monday at 3:30 p.m., Hot Grease on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Why We Cook, the Chef Smarty Pants radio show on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host, Chef Smarty Pants. So remember that if you're a fan of the show, you can always find the show and me on Facebook at Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. On Facebook, I would love to hear from you. Become a fan of the show. I have 199 fans. I'm waiting for number 200. Maybe it'll happen tonight. You want to be number 200? Do it. Also, people have been sending me little messages, which have been great. I love getting those. So let me, you know, keep those coming. Let me know what you think of the show. You can always leave comments also on the Heritage Radio Network website for all of our shows. And you know, of course, you can always podcast any of our shows on iTunes. So there is never a reason for you to miss a single episode of any of your favorite Heritage Radio shows. And not just mine. There's lots of other ones. There's the Plants show, the girls from We Dig Plants. I love those guys. There's the Naturalist, who happens to be my father. There are many of those fascinating and interesting shows here on Heritage Radio. So, anyway, it's 3 months to go until I go back to Ohio again to the Chef's Garden for their big food and wine festival. And I've talked about this before on here. I go out there every year to participate in the food and wine festival. The Chef's Garden is a farm in Ohio that specializes in heirloom produce that is grown in a highly sustainable way. They were really like the first people to do a lot of that stuff. Many, many heirloom varieties and microgreens and all of that stuff. And I've been going out there for years. And part of the Chef's Garden is they have an educational branch. And they have a program called Veggie U, which is a curriculum program for kids in elementary school to teach them about the whole Earth to Table concept. Which now it seems like every school in the world is doing. But 10 years ago, this was very revolutionary. And so every year to support Veggie U, they have a big food and wine festival. And every year I go and I participate and I have a tasting station. I've talked about this before. And in the past few years, I've teamed up with my pal Beej Flamholt, who I actually met at that event many years ago. And we used to do separate stations. But now we've been teaming up together because we like to work together. And every year at the event, there's a contest sponsored by Steelite. And Steelite is a company that makes high-end restaurant china and glasses and flatware and all of that stuff. Like, if you've ever eaten at, you know, Per Se, you've eaten off of Steelite. Any high-end restaurant uses it. So Steelite sponsors this contest every year. And it used to always be that if you won the contest, you won an all-expenses-paid trip to El Bulli in Spain, which is really like the, you know, the birthplace of modernist cuisine. And so people would win this trip, and they'd get to fly to Roses, Spain, and go to El Bulli. And then last year, El Bulli announced that they were closing, so the trip switched to the French Laundry. And now, I don't know this year where they're going to take people. But every year I compete, and 1 year I didn't place at all, and 1 year I came in third. 2 years ago I came in third. So I didn't win the trip. I won a bunch of free Steelite product, which I actually never cashed in on, and it expired. Last year we came in fourth. Now, I am determined to win. I am going to win this thing, this trip. Although we think that maybe they're skewed in who they pick toward people who actually purchase Steelite products for their restaurants, because it's, you know, restaurant chefs, except for Beej and I, he's a caterer, and I'm, you know, whatever, teacher, radio person. We think they may be only picking winners who actually purchase their product, but maybe not. I don't know. So we have been, basically, since the event was over last July, talking about what we're going to do this year because we want to win. And I'm almost afraid to talk about what we're going to do because in case any of my competitors are listening, I don't want them to steal my idea. But what I do want to talk about is that we think that this year we're going to do goat as our protein. Now, you don't have to do a protein. The whole idea here is that it's a celebration of vegetables, the event, and so you should use as much Chef's Garden product as you possibly can on your plate. But I have also noticed that the people who win always have a protein because the Steelite people want to see your item as a tiny tasting size version of something that you could scale up to a restaurant size entree. And so having a protein helps, I think. And so I want to do goat next year. I've been thinking a lot about goat lately, and I've been reading a lot about goat lately, and I've been eating some goat lately, and goat is really good. And I think that goat is the next hot meat. I mean, you can already see it here in New York. It's showing up on a lot of restaurant menus. But I think goat is the meat of the future because look at how the population in the U.S. is changing. We have many, many, many Latino people moving here now. And we also have a big Muslim population. And both of those groups really love their goat. Plus, goats are highly sustainable animals to raise. You don't have to grow food to feed the goats like you do for cattle. You don't even really need grass like you do for cattle or for sheep. Goats are browsers, which means you let them out on a hillside somewhere and they'll just eat everything. They're good at that. They're also really good at clearing brush if you have land with brush. Remember George Bush used to go to Texas to clear brush on the ranch when he was supposed to be actually governing, running the country? He should have gotten goats instead. And the other thing about goat is that there are all these male goats that don't really serve any purpose because people raise goats primarily for the dairy, for the milk. And if you paid attention in biology, you'll know that only the females produce milk. So there are all these poor little billy goats, the males running around, and they are not producing any milk.
Heritage Foods actually has a campaign to sell male goats.
Yeah. That, you know what? That's where I saw it, on the Heritage Foods website. Oh, yeah. Thanks, Jack. There you go. Yeah. So Heritage Foods has a campaign to sell male goats. That's how come I know about this. That's where I saw it. So what do you do with the male goats? Well, we got to eat them. The only way to honor them is to eat them. I'm sure all the vegans out there, who probably don't listen to my show anyway, but if they're listening now, would be horrified. But we have to eat them. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to eat some male goat, and we're going to use it for our event. And I think with goat, we can win. I think we're going to be the only ones doing it. And they when they judge this event, a big part of the judging is they base it on how sustainable your dish is. You know, so I could do bluefin tuna. I don't think I would win with that. But what's more sustainable than an animal that doesn't need to have food produced for it? And the impact that goats have on land is much more minimal than cows or pigs. You don't get the giant pools of manure slurry, and you don't get them trampling down the soil and compacting it. And, you know, they're light on your feet. They're light on their feet or their hooves. They leave a much smaller footprint, hoof print, if you will. So we'll see. Maybe the goat will be what takes us over that hump, that edge, and we'll win. Who knows? We have until July. So we're going to be developing this dish over the next few months in secret, in our secret lab. And I'll keep you posted, but not in too much detail because I know that people who also compete in this thing are potentially listening to the show. So I'm a little paranoid about that. But anyway, to change the subject a little bit, last week's show was about greens. If you listened last week, I talked about how I'm a little bit sick of the root veg doldrums of winter. Too many turnips. And I've had greens on the brain. And so last week I talked about how I had been eating dandelions and escarole and stuff like that. And it's still going on. I've got greens on the brain. And when I get a chance to cook, that's all I want to cook. And then I was cooking greens the other day and sort of thinking about how I was like, it was like this visceral craving I had for greens. And I suddenly remembered something. I remembered something about when I did an internship. So I'm not being clear. 6 years ago, about 6 or 7 years ago, I won like a little scholarship through a foundation, and I went and spent 3 weeks on a lamb farm, a grass-fed lamb farm in western Pennsylvania. I may have talked about this before. And, you know, I had this image that I'd be out there like frolicking in the fields, like Heidi feeding baby lambs, you know, with a bottle and running around carrying a crook like shepherds do. But it didn't turn out that way. I didn't really have anything to do with the lambs until they were in the process of being killed. I never actually got to really pet even a live lamb or cuddle with one, which is really all I wanted to do, was go out there and cuddle with them and then eat a lot of them. I did wind up eating a lot of lamb. Out of the 21 nights I spent out there, I counted, we ate lamb 17 out of 21 nights. I mostly worked in the slaughterhouse and in the cutting room. And I also got very good at packing boxes with ice packs and putting UPS labels on them. I'm very good now with a tape gun. That's what you learn when you extern on a lamb farm. Not a lot of actual farming was going on. But this is what I remembered. I remembered going out there. But the thing I remembered as I was craving greens in a visceral way was that John Jamison, who's the owner of the farm, told me that they try to keep the lambs grass-fed all year round because that's the best way to do it. But sometimes in the winter, there isn't enough grass, so they have to supplement their feed with some hay. Hay or straw? I guess hay. Yeah, hay. And so they would bring them into the barn and they'd give them some hay just so they'd have enough food. And since they had to do that, sometimes the lambs in the spring get intestinal parasites from eating hay. I guess this happens fairly often. I'm not a farmer. I don't know. But when they have to go in and eat the hay in the winter, they can get parasites. And they know they have the parasites. Like, instinctively, they know it. And so when they go back out on the fields early in the spring, the first things that start growing in the spring usually are onion grass and wild garlic. And the lambs will go and they'll eat that stuff, not because it's the only food, but because it makes them puke. They eat it and it's like an emetic. It makes them throw up, and in the process they throw up the parasites. And so it's like they're going out and they're doing this little like wild garlic purge first thing in the spring. And it cleans them right out. Very clever, right? I sort of like that. So I sort of feel like those lambs, not that I need to go and throw up because I do not enjoy that at all. I try to avoid it, but I sort of feel like that I need that post-winter kind of purge, and I was eating all these greens thinking, I feel like those little lambs going out on the field, and I know just what I need to eat, and I thought that was kind of cool. So I have like a little lamb thing going on. It's like I'm craving the greens as a tonic after all of those parsnips that I've been shoving down all winter. You know, and it makes sense, right? We're all mammals. We all basically eat the same way. Some of us, I think, have gotten very far out of touch with eating that way. But that's what I'm here for. I'm trying to bring it all back around, bring it all back home to you. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately. I have to go home and watch some more episodes of Weeds now. But we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Have a good week.
The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey?
Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.